Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's date is the second day of a two-day war that lasted 6 years and killed nearly 60 million human beings and ushered in the nuclear age 3/4 of a century ago in the previous millennium. Today is also the second day that same war ended, September 2nd, 1945, the first nominal VJ day being August 14th, the preceding month. Not to forget the other half of that world war that ended on VE Day, the previous spring. Humanity's bifurcated calendar is infamously saturated with blood, tears, and sweat. Today's program is primarily concerned with the sweat portion. Labor Day is this next Monday, September 6th. Once upon a time in the last century of the former millennium, Labor Day briefly celebrated working people after mega millennia of neglect toward their labor, which, after all, built civilization as we know it. But now that is a joke. Labor Day is hardly notable anymore except as a bookend to the annual summer silly season, which traditionally begins on the gravestones of Memorial Day, a grotesque pretense of martial solemnity. Today's program is a salute to the bona fide meaning of Labor Day, not in the usual socio-economic political sense, which is ever more meaningless in the current degradation of unions and the labor movement, not to mention the current devolution of work by the pandemic. If not exactly a celebration, today's program is about a very ancient form of labor for food gathering carried out on earthly bodies of water, a most basic subsistence of sustenance, the vital occupation of piscatology, in particular, the quest for a fine kettle of fish. I start with something I wrote, the price of fish. A boat or a ship is much like a star, moving across the oceans in the same manner as a star through space and time. Its motion seems less from its own volition than the movement of the planet sliding beneath its keel. Points appear or disappear, approach or fade into horizontal haze. Days and nights pass and vanish as quickly as a ship's wake or a gull's cry. They have no meaning, simply a succession of minor cycles, like the rise and fall of tides upon a shore, memorable only because a few suns passed, a whale might have been sighted, or a storm made a voyage miserable and dangerous for a while. A feeling grows not unlike the ambiguous emptiness sought by Oriental religions, a sense of aimlessness, yet also of great wealth, though nothing is possessed. The movement of the ocean in tandem with the wind follows the rhythms of music, and life aboard a deck is a form of dance. The immensity of ocean is difficult to place into human reference. Though we chart it and make neighborhoods of navigation points, plat its surface into abstract grids, these are only thin trails through a vast prairie. It is impossible to not recognize its alienness to us, its antithesis to everything we find familiar and sustaining to our lives ashore. We nestle to the land like gophers in a burrow and feel that it cares for us. Nothing about the ocean gives us that comfort. We can change the land and conform it to ourselves. We can furrow and plant it. We can build cities and roads. The ocean defies us, refuses to remain still, and rolls past our flimsy ventures on its surface with infinite indifference. We might pollute it and destroy the life that has evolved within it, but we cannot destroy the ocean so completely as we might the land. The ocean is moved only by the wind, sun, and moon, also by the planet's spin. Yet some humans feel about the ocean as they do about their blood. They cherish the aloneness they find on the ocean, an inexplicable paradox of feeling so personally about the implacably insensible. Those who leave shore and sail out onto the ocean become free prisoners, held to splinters of wood or metal in a seemingly limitless space, kin to families of seabirds that crowd onto passing logs, related also to fiery trails that cross night skies. They cling to their little boats for more than awareness they cannot walk on water or live long immersed in it. They design their vessels to be solid and seaworthy, familiar perspectives of angles and curves that enclose like wombs each vessel a seed of human civilization. They might pretend they are masters of their decks and of the planet, empowered over water and universe. But these are hollow lies amid surging mountains of water that rise and fall with the intensity of lungs and the power to crush boats and men into ocean dust. The presence of death is as close as skin. What the ocean might have seemed to earliest humans is not recorded. Our ancestors must have first approached the ocean as at present we move beyond Earth into space. The first voyages were probably short and timid trips for fish in relatively shallow waters on the lower lips of continents that are rich in sea life. While landsmen experimented with spears and axes for hunting land animals, peoples along ocean shores hollowed out logs and developed paddles and oars for velocity and direction, later sails, and they invented hooks, lines, and nets. Several thousand years later, ocean fishing from boats and decks remains one of the most dangerous methods of food gathering. In clear weather, and most often in foul, fishermen have for centuries gone out into the wild ocean in flimsy cockle shells. Life on fishing boats is hard, lean, and forthright, and the men and women who pull lines or pots or work nets are always close to injury or death. As fishing stocks diminish and regulations become more severe, boats and crews take greater risks that call for intensifying skill and courage. For all its modernization, ocean fishing is a primitive chase of hunter and hunted across a deadly wilderness. Almost everyone who chooses a livelihood on a boat accepts the probability that they will die in the water. Every year, fishing and seafaring communities mourn the loss of friends, neighbors, family members, and shipmates who die at sea. The bodies of some are recovered, but more disappear, and nothing else will be known of them or their vessels. Edward Hellberg and his son, also named Edward, were fishermen. Both men were born and raised in Astoria and spent most of their lives on the decks of boats, and both died at sea. The elder Hellberg was lost with three others of his crew when the shark boat Republic disappeared in a storm in waters off the Columbia River Bar in February 1945. His son died in August 1986 when a large ship suddenly turned into the old and familiar trawler McKinley and cut it in half near Gray's Harbor, a few miles north of where his father's boat sank. The younger Edward Hellberg started fishing when he was a boy sometime after his father's death. He worked on several fishing crews and owned a succession of boats, one of which sank in the Gulf of Mexico. Fathers and sons, sometimes mothers and daughters, worked aboard decks with him. He was a man skippers never had to tell what to do. Two of his daughters, who worked as waitresses at a riverside restaurant, always watched for his boat going downriver to the ocean or returning. He waved at them during daylight and flashed a boat light at the restaurant windows at night. When the McKinley was struck, he saved a shipmate from drowning in the forecastle. He died because he was in the cold water too long. His shipmates were younger and less affected by hypothermia and survived. It is not difficult to imagine how they felt, left alone in a cold and dark ocean, abandoned by the ship that ran them down. When a Coast Guard helicopter found them, they had been in the water almost an hour, clinging to a life ring. They scrambled for a wire basket the helicopter dropped, but Eddie could not hold on and fell back into the water. For the first time in its history, a Coast Guardsman dove into the ocean at night and retrieved his body. Resuscitation failed to revive him. Many who attended his memorial service in Astoria, which has lost hundreds of its citizens to the ocean, have mourned dead parents, children, friends, and lovers who died with their vessels. And his fellow fishermen who came to say goodbye were aware they might also lose boats and perhaps their lives. After his death, one of his granddaughters, who was four then, got through the painful ordeal of his loss by imagining she was holding her grandfather's hand. A most important rule of ocean voyages is looking out for other vessels, of keeping a good watch not only for the protection of one's own craft, but for any that might be in danger. Ships and crews must also respond to the distress of other ships or search the ocean for survivors of sunken vessels. Coastal waters are particularly dangerous because of the large numbers of small craft that are continually run over by large ships that rely ever more often on mechanical devices rather than human eyesight. A number of questions about the sinking of the McKinley remain. Two are primary: why a good watch was not kept to prevent collision, and why the ship did not stop to rescue or drop a lifeboat to rescue McKinley's crew. The answers will not resurrect the highly regarded McKinley, nor return life to the good and decent man Eddie Hellberg. But on the ocean, and soon in outer space, the human beings who venture out from shore and planet must be responsible for each other, or they will likely die. And that was The Price of Fish. And now, from a diary I kept my first season on a tuna boat, 2 days aboard the Albacore troller Falling Star. August 26th. It is a splendid day. The morning sun is as bright as a lamp, shining also from 1,000 waves like drops of blinding white fire, and the ocean is deep blue. Our tiny fish boat is stubbornly plowing uphill against a strong northwest current, which rises in swells of dancing blue mountains. Just below the translucent surface, where sunbeams spread as many fans, thousands of pink jellyfish open their parasols and resemble lustrous necklaces. Often a blue shark scurries away in fright from our path, and just as often, large brown and white porpoises dive and play around our plunging bow. The tattered froth of the bow wave, which tears into forms resembling the skeletons of the fish we have killed, washes back to the stern to be caught in the gurgling upheaval of the prop. Tons of water churned up by our motor explode into blue lotus pods laced with clear impatient creams. A disturbed stream of confused swells knock together all along the wake of our passage. Early this morning, just before dawn, I sat on topside bridge watch under the dying stars, awaiting the rising sun. The waters were quiet, sluggish in the morning chill, perhaps waiting as I was. The expanding horizon was unbound by the retreating darkness, while meteorites zipped across the softening sky, as erratic and shining as the phosphorus streaks of fish skittering out of our way. The sky to the east filled with a dark blush of red wine, brightening to a glorious orange. Then rose the sun straight out of the water, a magnificent wrinkled fire that kindled a flashy red trail to our wooden hull as if to set it blazing. I feel a grand and happiness, watching the blue swells as they rise far out along the ragged rim and roll on toward us to splash endlessly against our bow, bursting into foam and spray. Seabirds hunt among them, gliding through the valleys and skipping above the mountains that race past. Purple and cream clouds silently drop out of sight along the horizon as the bright sun rises higher in the sky and dances madly across the water. I feel immense love toward the little boat that for the present is my only home. I have no furniture other than a crib built into the port side of the hull. I sleep in the cramped, smelly forecastle, but there is no evidence of me there except for a sea bag filled with clothes and a few books. When I bathe, it is with a bucket of seawater and a plastic bottle of dishwashing liquid. My clothes are washed in the same manner and strung up to dry along lines that run from the rigging to a small house just aft of the stubby bow. I spend most of my time in a cockpit in the stern and watch fish lines that extend from two long poles spread like bony wings on either side of the boat. We fish for albacore tuna, although this season we are also rigged for crabbing. We alternate, spending some days close to shore working a long line of submerged crab pots, or weeks out at sea hunting albacore. Today we are probably 200 miles west of the North American continent and begin a tedious day scratching up and down the same miles of water. A dozen lines of varying lengths with unbarbed and feathered hooks skip along behind us just below the surface, sometimes raising little clouds of spray. Until the skipper relieves me, I stay on the topside bridge above the house and watch the ocean for boats and birds, the former to avoid, but the latter to pursue. We are well outside the ship lanes and the huge mass of foreign fishing vessels that cluster a few miles offshore like a World War II invasion fleet. Most boats out this far are competitors, and though we will attempt radio contact with every fish boat we sight in case its name is among a growing list of missing boats, the skipper wishes to avoid the tuna fleet. He prefers to hunt alone. We welcome the sight of birds, however. Great flocks of them diving upon the ocean is a sign of plankton, which might indicate the presence of albacore schools feeding from below. The skipper takes the watch. His hard eyes smolder belligerently from a face covered with wild brown hair. He is a few years older than I am, and most of his life has been spent on decks of one sort or another. His father was a merchant sailor, and so was he for a number of years. He tells me the glass is dropping, that we are in for a blow. We plow the same water hour after hour, but catch no albacore. A wind blows steadily from the northwest, raising white caps among the deep blue swells. My shipmate, Kamiju, and I stand or sit in the cockpit, watching the lines or staring off at the horizons. We are swaddled in yellow slickers, and each of us wears a dark woolen watch cap. The skipper comes back to the stern a few times and glowers at us, as if we are responsible that no fish has grabbed a hook. At noon, several porpoises pass us. Kamiju sights them off the starboard stern. They hurtle through the choppy sea, silently, not giving us a glance, which is unusual. Most of the time, porpoises detour for a play around the bow. This group passes our boat as if it is standing still. Later, when the sun is a red ball and clouds begin to blossom on the western horizon, a big gray whale raises itself just off our stern and blows a tall plume of spray that is scattered by the wind. Its immense bulk is so close aboard that Kamiju's eyes almost pop out of his head. The whale sounds, and for a second, its fluke rises from the water like a monument. The ocean is a dark blue when the sun begins its fall. Two huge clouds that resemble giant birds with outspread wings fly out of the west. Their wings and bodies are burnished brown, and their breasts are bright orange. Long drum rolls of clouds, so distant I can barely see them, start to crawl over the horizon as if they were fleets of ships coming towards us. It is into them the red ball descends, and from them its blood explodes into the sky in vivid oranges and reds. The skipper appears in the open hatchway of the boathouse and shouts for us to coil lines. Kamiju grins a smile that says, "It is about time." I agree. My thoughts fill with food and sleep. At that exact moment, a line I am pulling out of the water is snatched from my hand. In the same instant, all lines still in the water are suddenly taut. Kamiju pulls out a wire attached to a bell inside the house. The skipper reappears in the hatch. "How many?" he shouts. "All of them," I yell back. He stands uncertainly in the hatchway. He puts his head into the wind, which has got stronger since the sun went down, and glares uneasily at the rising seas. He makes up his mind and disappears inside to put the wheel on automatic pilot, the iron mic. He crosses the deck and wedges between Kamiju and me in the cockpit. Already the deck behind is filling with frantically dying albacore. They keep coming. No sooner is a line tossed back into the water than it has a fish on it. We pull them in for almost 2 hours. It is an immense, awesome suicide. Within the first hour, I am exhausted and spend the rest of the time praying for the fish to stop. Kamiju laughs and keeps up a running stream of erotic wit. The skipper is silent. I hear his hoarse breathing and smell the rancid sweat steaming from underneath his slickers. Only once does he speak, and it is when I lose a fish, so his remarks are uncomplimentary. All three of us lurch against the pitching of the deck. We stumble into each other and hit each other with fish. Lines tangle. Hooks get caught on clothing or on loose gear in the cockpit. A gaff is lost overboard. My hands are slimy with scales and guts, and they sting from dozens of hook punctures mixed with salt water. Above the sounds of wind and water and the straining of our motor, I hear the death drums of hundreds of albacore all over the deck. The entire stern and the walkways on either side are piled with dying or dead fish. Some of them fall back into the cockpit and flop around our feet. I feel about to die myself when finally, as suddenly as they struck our lines, they quit. We stand a while waiting for a line to stiffen, but none do. Behind us, the last to die beat their bodies into the bloody deck boards. The skipper shakes his head like coming out of a dream. He climbs out of the cockpit and lurches over the dead fish into the house. He swings the boat in a reckless turn that throws Kamiju and I into each other and threatens to broach us in the heavy swells. When the prow is pointed east, the skipper leans out of the house and shouts for Kamiju and I to stack the corpses in bins down in the hold. It takes almost all the rest of the night and fills half the hold with albacore that we cover with ice, layer by layer, as one might frost a cake. When we are finished, rather than sleep, it is my turn on watch. We run through the night. I sit topside on watch. Our bearing is exactly 90 degrees. The wheel is locked on automatic, known by salts as the Iron Mike. We wallow through the trough of the northwest current. The wind is at gale force. It howls madly through the rigging and throws spray into my face. The sky fills with low-bottom clouds. The moon periodically knifes holes into the clouds and stares at me like an unfriendly eye. August 27th. We are plowing through dirty green seas beneath a gray and yellow sky. It is just after dawn, and we are running for shore because of storm. Light from the rising sun beams through holes in the clouds, and the ocean ahead raises in tier upon tier of golden sea, a great, wildly dancing pagoda. The wind slaps against our little wooden matchbox with a fury that shakes us like a mother would her child caught misbehaving. The old boat shudders and climbs halfway up the sleet-filled sky on the breaking crest of a mountain to swell one instant, then falls sickeningly down its backside as if it will plunge straight down forever. Again and again we rise and fall as if time was a carousel, a kaleidoscope whirl of mountains and valleys growing and wearing away in mere instants. For the first time, I get a little seasick, and Kamiju laughs at me. In the late afternoon, we sight land and turn north against the wind and current. We beat ourselves senseless against the unceasingly oncoming swells. Tons of water crash into the bow and wash across the decks to the stern. We are beat around so roughly, it is almost impossible to stand, even when clinging to supports such as railings or bulkheads. We sit at the galley table in the house and stare wordlessly out at the seas that roar past after punching us in the nose, or we watch whoever wrestles the wheel. The skipper came down from the flying bridge when it got too nasty to remain up there, and we take turns at the helm in the house. We peer through the wet and fogged windows while fighting to remain on our feet. We watch anxiously for deadheads, which are half-submerged logs that got away from timber rafts in the Columbia River or washed down from rain and erosion, so-called because of their capacity to stove in the sides of a wood boat and sink it. We look for other boats that are also running for home, but sight none. We are alone against the storm. At one point, Kamiju is sent below to check for water in the hold and to make sure the dead fish haven't been thrown all around. After an hour at the wheel, during which I think both my arms are breaking and my legs are pumped dry of blood, I drop down into the dark forecastle and crawl into my cramped bunk that stinks of fish, dirty clothes, and countless seasons of unwashed deckhands. I can't sleep. I lay awake and stare up through a small hole at the skipper's black rubber boots as he takes a turn at the helm. I listen to the water that pounds against the hull next to my head. Sometimes at night when I lay in my bunk and the water is gentler against my ears, its gurgles sound like voices of children who laugh and call out my name. Half an hour after midnight, we cross the Columbia River Bar, known to sea dogs and pukers as a graveyard of ships. Huge black swells grapple to crush us or roll us over. They toss and shake us like a dog with a sock, but we splash through them and limp into the main channel and the quieter river current. The lights of Astoria climb its hills like they were on a Christmas tree, and the white and red streaks of automobiles that cross the 4-mile bridge to Washington shine like gems. The three of us are back on top, the skipper once more on the outside wheel. It is a wonderful moment. All day I had pleaded with any god that might be above the stormy sky to save me from the wind and monstrous swells, and I promised again and again that I would never venture into water deeper than a bathtub if I made shore safely. Now I can break the promise, as I have numerous times. I am safe again, and once more, no longer afraid. I think the greatest thing in the world is to be an albacore tuna fisherman. God damn it, Kamiju laughs. We made it again. And an epilogue. On August 29, 1972, the fishing vessel Meteor capsized and sank in the Columbia River Bar at the South Jetty after crossing from the ocean with a load of Dungeness crab. The four of us aboard were rescued by other fishermen at great risk to their boats and lives. More than 2,000 river and ocean craft have sunk in or near the Columbia River Bar in the last two centuries, and at least 700 persons have died. No records exist of the losses of native mariners who crossed the bar for thousands of years, except perhaps in lost local lore. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk engineers this program. Keith Jarrett provides the piano intro. Oregon is being hit hard at this very moment by twin plagues of virus and anti-vaxxers who spread their contagion of medieval ignorance and contemporary stupidity as vapidly as psychosis. An RN friend who is on the front line of the corona assault is besieged by in-laws who treat her as the Antichrist and endanger their three grandchildren with blasphemous Gothic incantations of hypocritical hypocrisy. Stand fast against the superstitious sophistry. Mask up and lock down against the stupid and heretical. Do not for a minute forget that medical self-defense protects everybody else in these worst of times. Happy Labor Day.